were found during the arrest, so you don't have one without the other. That won't fly in any court I've ever been in. I had the feeling that he knew everything I was saying and that the call was simply following a script. We were going where Posey wanted us to go, and that was fine with me. This time I wanted to go there too.
Then maybe we can just talk about a disposition on the matter, he said, as if the idea had just occurred to him.
And there we were. We had come to the place Posey had wanted to get to from the moment he'd answered the call. I'm open to it, Dwight. You should know that my client voluntarily entered a rehab program after his arrest. He has completed the program, has full-time employment, and has been clean for 4 months. He'll give his piss anytime, anywhere to prove it.
That is really good to hear, Posey said with false enthusiasm. The DA's office, as well as the courts, always looks favorably upon voluntary rehabilitation.
Tell me something I don't know, I almost said. The kid is doing good. I can vouch for that. What do you want to do for him? I knew how the script would read now. Posey would turn it into a goodwill gesture from the prosecution. He would make it seem as though the DA's office were giving out the favor here, when the truth was that the prosecution was acting to insulate an important figure from political and personal embarrassment. That was fine with me. I didn't care about the political ends of the deal as long as my client got what I wanted him to get.
Tell you what, Mick, let's make it go away, and maybe Patrick can use this opportunity to move ahead with being a productive member of society.
Sounds like a plan to me, Dwight. You're making my day. And his.
Okay, then get me his rehab records, and we'll put it into a package for the judge.
Posey was talking about making it a pretrial intervention case. Patrick would have to take biweekly drug tests, and in 6 months, the case would go away if he kept clean. He would still have an arrest on his record, but no conviction. Unless... You willing to expunge his record? I asked.
That's asking a lot, Mickey. He did, after all, break in and steal the diamonds.
He didn't break in, Dwight. He was invited in. And the alleged diamonds are what this is all about, right? Whether or not he actually did steal any diamonds. Posey must have realized he had misspoken by bringing up the diamonds. He folded his tent quickly.
All right, fine. We'll put it into the package.
You're a good man, Dwight.
I try to be. You will withdraw your motion now?
First thing tomorrow. When do we go to court? I have a trial starting the end of next week.
Then we'll go for Monday. I'll let you know.
I hung up the phone and called the reception desk on the intercom. Luckily, Lorna answered. I thought you were sent home, I said.
We are about to go through the door. I'm going to leave my car here and go with Cisco.
What, on his donor cycle?
Excuse me, Dad, but I don't think you have anything to say about that.
I groaned. But I do have a say over who works as my investigator. If I can keep you two apart, maybe I can keep you alive.
Mickey, don't you dare.
Can you just tell Cisco I need that address for the liquidator?
I will, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Hope so. Wear a helmet. I hung up and Cisco came in, carrying a post-it note in one hand and a gun in a leather holster in the other. He walked around the desk, put the post-it down in front of me, and then opened a drawer and put the weapon in it. What are you doing? I asked. You can't give me a gun.
It's totally legal and registered to me.
That's great, but you can't give it to me.
That's ill. I'm not giving it to you. I'm just storing it here because I'm done work for the day. I'll get it in the morning. Okay?
Whatever. I think you two are overreacting.
Better than underreacting. See you tomorrow.
Thank you. Will you send Patrick in before you go?
You got it. And by the way, I always make her wear a helmet.
I looked at him and nodded. That's good, Cisco. He left the room, and Patrick soon came in. Patrick, Cisco's talked to Vincent's liquidator, and he still has one of your longboards. You can go by and pick it up. Just tell him you're picking it up for me and to call me if there's any problem.
Oh, man! Thank you!
Yeah, well, I've got even better news than that on your case.
What happened?
I went over the phone call I just had with Dwight Posey. As I told Patrick that he would do no jail time if he stayed clean, I watched his eyes gain a little light. It was as if I could see the burden drop off his shoulders. He could look once again at the future.
I have to call my mom, he said. She's going to be so happy.
Yeah, well,
I hope you are too.
I am, I am.
Now, the way I figure it, you owe me a couple of thousand for my work on this. That's about 2.5 weeks of driving. If you want, you can stick with me until it's paid off. After that, we can talk about it and see where we're at.
That sounds good. I like the job.
Good, Patrick. Then it's a deal. Patrick smiled broadly and was turning to go.
One other thing, Patrick.
He turned back to me.
I saw you sleeping in your car in the garage this morning.
Sorry, I'll find another spot.
He looked down at the floor.
No, I'm sorry, I said. I forgot that you told me when we talked on the phone the first time that you were living in your car and sleeping on a lifeguard stand. I just don't know how safe it is to be sleeping in the same garage where a guy got shot the other night.
I'll find someplace else.
Well, if you want, I can give you an advance on your pay. Would that help you maybe get a motel room or something?
I guess.
I was glad to help him out, but I knew that living out of a weekly motel was almost as depressing as living out of a car.
I'll tell you what, I said. If you want, you could stay with me for a couple of weeks, until you get some money in your pocket and maybe get a better plan going.
At your place?
Yeah, you know, temporarily.
With you?
I realized my mistake.
Nothing like that, Patrick. I've got a house, and you'd have your own room. In fact, on Wednesday nights, and every other weekend, it'd be better if you stayed with a friend or in a motel. That's when I have my daughter.
He thought about it and nodded.
Yeah, I could do that.
I reached across the desk and signaled him to give me back the post-it with the liquidator's address on it. I wrote my own address on it while I spoke.
Why don't you go pick up your board and then head over to my place at this second address? Fairholm is right off Laurel Canyon, one street before Mount Olympus. You go up the stairs to the front porch, and there's a table and chairs out there and an ashtray. The extra key's under the ashtray. The guest bedroom is right next to the kitchen. Just make yourself at home.
Thanks.
He took the post-it back and looked at the address I'd written. I probably won't get there till late, I told him. I've got a trial starting next week and a lot of work to do before then.
Okay.
Look, we're only talking about a few weeks, till you get on your feet again. Meantime, maybe we can help each other out. You know, like if one of us starts to feel the pull, maybe the other one will be there to talk about it. Okay?
Okay.
We were quiet for a moment, probably both of us thinking about the deal. I didn't tell Patrick that he might end up helping me more than I would help him. In the past 48 hours, the pressure of the new caseload had begun to weigh on me. I could feel myself being pulled back, feel the desire to go to the cotton-wrapped world the pills could give me. The pills opened the space between where I was and the brick wall of reality. I was beginning to crave that distance. Up front and deep down, I knew I didn't want that again, and maybe Patrick could help me avoid it.
Thanks, Mr. Haller.
I looked up at him from my thoughts. Call me Mickey, I said, and I should be the one saying thanks.
Why are you doing all this for me?
I looked at the big fish on the wall behind him for a moment, then back at him. I'm not sure, Patrick, but I'm hoping that if I help you, then I'll be helping myself. Patrick nodded like he knew what I was talking about. That was strange because I wasn't sure myself what I had meant.
Go get your board, Patrick, I said. I'll see you at the house, and make sure you remember to call your mother.
After I was finally alone in the office, I started the process the way I always do, with clean pages and sharp points. From the supply closet, I retrieved 2 fresh legal pads and 4 black Warrior pencils. I sharpened their points and got down to work. Vincent had broken the Elliott case into 2 files. One file contained the state's case, and the second, thinner file, contained the defense case. The weight of the defense file was not of concern to me. The defense played by the same rules of discovery as the prosecution. Anything that went into the second file went to the prosecutor. A seasoned defense attorney knew to keep the file thin. Keep the rest in your head, or hidden on a microchip in your computer if it is safe. I had neither Vincent's head nor his laptop, but I was sure the secrets Jerry Vincent kept were hidden somewhere in the hard copy. The magic bullet was there. I just had to find it.
I began with the thicker file, the prosecution's case. I read straight through, every page and every word. I took notes on one legal pad and drew a time and action flowchart on the other. I studied the crime scene photographs with a magnifying glass I took from the desk drawer. I drew up a list of every single name I encountered in the file. From there, I moved on to the defense file and again read every word on every page. The phone rang two different times, but I didn't even look up to see what name was on the screen. I didn't care. I was in relentless pursuit and cared about only one thing: finding the magic bullet. When I was finished with the Elliott files, I opened the Wims case and read every document and report it contained, a time-consuming process. Because Wims was arrested following a public incident that had drawn several uniform and SWAT deputies, this file was thick with reports from the various units involved and personnel at the scene. It was stuffed with transcriptions of the conversations with Wims, as well as weapons and ballistics reports, a lengthy evidence inventory, witness statements, dispatch records, and patrol deployment reports. There were a lot of names in the file, and I checked every one of them against the list of names from the Elliott files. I also cross-referenced every address. I had this client once. I don't even know her name because I was sure that the name she was under in the system was not her own. She was in on a first offense, but she knew the system too well to be a virgin. In fact, she knew everything too well. Whatever her name was, she had somehow rigged the system and it had her down as someone she wasn't. The charge was burglary of an occupied dwelling, but there was so much more than that behind the one charge. This woman liked to target hotel rooms where men with large amounts of money slept. She knew how to pick them, follow them, then finesse the door locks and the room safes while they slept. In one candid moment, probably the only one in our relationship, she told me of the white-hot adrenaline high she got every time the last digit fell into place and she heard the electronic gears of the hotel safe start to move and unlock. Opening the safe and finding what was inside was never as good as that magic moment when the gears began to grind and she felt the velocity of her blood moving in her veins. Nothing before or after was as good as at that moment. The jobs weren't about the money. They were about the velocity of blood. I nodded when she told me all of this. I had never broken into a hotel room while some guy was snoring on the bed, but I knew about the moment when the gears began to grind. I knew about the velocity. I found what I was looking for an hour into my second run at the files. It had been there in front of me the whole time. First in Elliott's arrest report, and then on the time and action chart I had drawn myself. I called the chart the Christmas tree. It always started basic and unadorned, just the bare-bones facts of the case. Then, as I continued to study and make the case my own, I started hanging lights and ornaments on it, details and witness statements, evidence and lab results. Soon, the tree was lit up and bright. Everything about the case was there for me to see in the context of time and action. I had paid particular attention to Walter Elliott as I had drawn the Christmas tree. He was the tree trunk, and all the branches came from him. I had his movements, statements, and actions noted by time. 12:40 p.m. W.E. arrives at beach house. 12:50 p.m. W.E. discovers bodies. 1:05 p.m. W.E. calls 911. 1:24 p.m. W.E. calls 911 again. 1:28 p.m. Deputies arrive on scene. 1:30 p.m. W.E. secured. 2:15 p.m. Homicide arrives. 2:40 p.m. W.E. taken to Malibu Station. 4:55 p.m. W.E. interviewed, advised. 5:40 p.m. W.E. transported to Whittier. 7 p.m. GSR testing. 8 p.m. Second interview attempt, declined, arrested. 8:40 p.m. W.E. transported to Men's Central. Some of the times I estimated, but most came directly from the arrest report and other documents in the file. Law enforcement in this country is as much about the paperwork as anything else. I could always count on the prosecution file for reconstructing a timeline. On the second go-round, I used both the pencil point and eraser and started adding decorations to the tree. 12:40 p.m. W.E. arrives at beach house, front door unlocked. 12:50 p.m. W.E. discovers bodies, balcony door open. 1:05 p.m. W.E. calls 911, waits outside. 1:24 p.m. W.E. calls 911 again, what's the holdup? 1:28 p.m. Deputies arrive on scene, Murray, 4 Alpha 1, and Harbor, 4 Alpha 2. 1:30 p.m. W.E. secured, placed in patrol car, Murray/Harbor, search house. 2:15 p.m. Homicide arrives, first team, Kinder, number 14492, and Erickson, number 21101. Second team, Joshua, number 22234, and Tolls, number 15154. 2:30 p.m. W.E. taken inside house, describes discovery. 2:40 p.m. W.E. taken to Malibu Station, Joshua and Tolls transport. 4:55 p.m. W.E. interviewed, advised, Kinder takes lead in interview. 5:40 p.m. W.E. transported to Whittier, Joshua/Tolls. 7 p.m. GSR testing, FT Anita Sherman lab transport, Sherman. 8 p.m. Second interview, Erickson in lead, W.E. declines, got smart. 8:40 p.m. W.E. transported to Men's Central, Joshua/Tolls. As I had constructed the Christmas tree, I kept a separate list on another page of every human being mentioned in the sheriff's reports. I knew this would become the witness list I would turn over to the prosecution the following week. As a rule, I blanket the case, subpoenaing anybody mentioned in the investigative record just to be safe. You can always cut down a witness list at trial. Sometimes adding to it can be a problem. From the witness list and the Christmas tree, I would be able to infer how the prosecution would roll out its case. I would also be able to determine which witnesses the prosecution team was avoiding and possibly why. It was while I was studying my work and thinking in these terms that I felt the gears begin to grind and the cold finger of revelation went down my spine. Everything became clear and bright, and I found Jerry Vincent's magic bullet. Walter Elliott had been taken from the crime scene to the Malibu station so that he would be out of the way and secured while the lead detectives continued their on-site investigation. One short interview was conducted at the station before Elliott ended it. He was then transported to Sheriff's headquarters in Whittier, where a gunshot residue test was conducted and his hands tested positive for nitrates associated with gunpowder. Afterward, Kinder and Erickson took another stab at interviewing their suspect, but he wisely declined. He was then formally placed under arrest and booked into county jail. It was standard procedure, and the arrest report documented the chain of Elliott's custody. He was handled solely by the homicide detectives as he was moved from crime scene to substation to headquarters to jail. But it was how he was handled previous to their arrival that caught my eye. It was here that I saw something I had missed earlier. Something as simple as the designations of the uniformed deputies who first responded to the call. According to the records, Deputies Murray and Harbor had the designations 4 Alpha 1 and 4 Alpha 2 after their names, and I had seen at least one of those designations in the WIMS file. Jumping from case to case and from file to file, I found the WIMS arrest report and quickly scanned the narrative, not stopping until my eyes came to the first reference to the 4 Alpha 1 designation. Deputy Todd Stallworth had the designation written after his name. He was the deputy originally called to investigate the report of gunfire at Malibu Creek State Park. He was the deputy driving the car WIMS fired upon, and at the end of the standoff, he was the deputy who formally placed WIMS under arrest and took him to jail. I realized that 4 Alpha 1 did not refer to a specific deputy, but to a specific patrol zone or responsibility. The Malibu District covered the huge unincorporated areas of the West County, from the beaches of Malibu, up over the mountains and into the communities of Thousand Oaks and Calabasas. I assumed that this was the 4th District, and Alpha was the specific designation for a patrol unit, a specific car. It seemed to be the only way to explain why deputies who worked different shifts would share the same designation on different arrest reports. Adrenaline crashed into my veins, and my blood took off running as everything came together. All in a moment, I realized what Vincent had been up to and what he had been planning. I didn't need his laptop or his legal pads anymore. I didn't need his investigator. I knew exactly what the defense strategy was. At least I thought I did. I pulled my cell phone and called Cisco. I skipped the pleasantries. Cisco, it's me. Do you know any sheriff's deputies?
A few. Why?
Any of them work out of the Malibu station?
I know one guy who used to. He's in Linwood now. Malibu is too boring.
Can you call him tonight?
Tonight? Sure, I guess. What's up?
I need to know what the patrol designation for Alpha 1 means. Can you get that?
Shouldn't be a problem. I'll call you back. But hold on a sec for Lorna. She wants to talk to you.
I waited while she was given the phone. I could hear TV noise in the background. I had interrupted a scene of domestic bliss. Mickey, are you still there at the office?
I'm here.
It's 8:30. I think you should go home.
I think I should, too. I'm going to wait to hear back from Cisco. He's checking something out for me. And then I think I'm going over to Dan Tanis to have steak and spaghetti.
She knew I went to Dan Tanis when I had something to celebrate, usually a good verdict. You had steak for breakfast.
Then I guess this will make it a perfect day.
Things went well tonight.
I think so, real well.
You're going alone?
She said it with sympathy in her voice. Like now that she had hooked up with Cisco, she was starting to feel sorry for me, alone out there in the big bad world.
Craig or Christian will keep me company.
Craig and Christian worked the door at Dan Tanis. They took care of me whether I came in alone or not.
I'll see you tomorrow, Lorna. Okay, Mickey, have fun.
I already am.
I hung up and waited, pacing in the room and thinking it all through again. The dominoes went down one after the other. It felt good, and it all fit. Vincent had not taken on the Wims case out of any obligation to the law or the poor or the disenfranchised. He was using Wims as camouflage. Rather than move the case toward the obvious plea agreement, he had stashed Wims out at Camarillo for 3 months, thereby keeping the case alive and active. Meantime, he gathered information under the flag of the Wims defense that he would use in the Elliott case, thereby hiding his motives and strategy from the prosecution. Technically, he was probably acting within bounds, but ethically, it was underhanded. Eli Wims had spent 90 days in a state facility so Vincent could build a defense for Elliott. Elliott got the magic bullet, while Wims got the zombie cocktail. The good thing was, I didn't have to worry about the sins of my predecessor. Wims was out of Camarillo, and besides, they weren't my sins. I could just take the benefit of Vincent's discoveries and go to trial. It didn't take too long before Cisco called back.
I talked to my guy in Linwood. 4 Alpha is Malibu's lead car. The 4 is for the Malibu station, and the Alpha is for... Alpha, like the Alpha dog. The leader of the pack. Hotshots, the priority calls, usually go to the Alpha car. 4 Alpha 1 would be the driver, and if he's riding with a partner, then the partner would be 4 Alpha 2.
So the Alpha car covers the whole 4th district.
That's what he told me. 4 Alpha is free to roam the district and scoop the cream off the top.
What do you mean?
The best calls, the hot shots.
Got it. My theory was confirmed. A double murder and shots fired near a residential neighborhood would certainly be Alpha car calls. One designation, but different deputies responding. Different deputies responding, but one car. The dominoes clicked and fell.
Does that help, Mick?
It does, Cisco. But it also means more work for you.
On the Elliott case?
No, not Elliott. I want you to work on the Eli Wims case. Find out everything you can about the night he was arrested. Get me details.
That's what I'm here for.
The night's discovery pushed the case off the paper and into my imagination. I was starting to get courtroom images in my head, scenes of examinations and cross-examinations. I was laying out the suits I would wear to court and the postures I would take in front of the jury.
The case was coming alive inside, and this was always a good thing. It was a momentum thing. You time it right, and you go into trial with the inescapable conviction that you will not lose. I didn't know what had happened to Jerry Vincent, how his actions might have brought about his demise, or whether his death was linked at all to the Elliott case, but I felt as though I had a beat on things. I had velocity, and I was getting battle ready. My plan was to sit in a corner booth at Dan Tana's and sketch out some of the key witness examinations, listing the baseline questions and probable answers for each. I was excited about getting to it, and Lorna need not have worried about me. I wouldn't be alone. I would have my case with me. Not Jerry Vincent's case, mine. After quickly repacking the files and adding fresh pencils and legal pads, I killed the lights and locked the office door. I headed down the hallway and then across the bridge to the parking garage. Just as I was entering the garage, I saw a man walking up the ramp from the first floor. He was 50 yards away, and it was only a few moments and a few strides before I recognized him as the man in the photograph Bosch had shown me that morning. My blood froze in my heart. The fight-or-flight instinct stabbed into my brain. The rest of the world didn't matter. There was just this moment, and I had to make a choice. My brain assessed the situation faster than any computer IBM ever made. And the result of the computation was that I knew the man coming toward me was the killer and that he had a gun. I swung around and started to run. "Hey!" a voice called from behind me. I kept running. I moved back across the bridge to the glass doors leading back into the building. One clear, single thought fired through every synapse in my brain. I had to get inside and get to Cisco's gun. I had to kill or be killed. But it was after hours, and the doors had locked behind me as I had left the building. I shot my hand into my pocket in search of the key, then jerked it out, bills, coins, and wallet flying with it. As I jammed the key into the lock, I could hear running steps coming up quickly behind me. "The gun! Get the gun!" I finally yanked the door open and bolted down the hallway toward the office. I glanced behind me and saw the man catch the door just before it closed and locked. He was still coming. Key still in my hand, I reached the office door and fumbled the key while getting it into the lock. I could feel the killer closing in. Finally getting the door open, I entered, slammed it shut, and threw the lock. I hit the light switch, then crossed the reception area and charged into Vincent's office. The gun Cisco left for me was there in the drawer. I grabbed it, yanked it out of its holster, and went back out to the reception area. Across the room, I could see the killer's shape through the frosted glass. He was trying to open the door. I raised the gun and pointed at the blurred image. I hesitated and then raised the gun higher and fired two shots into the ceiling. The sound was deafening in the closed room.
"That's right," I yelled. "Come on in!"
The image on the other side of the glass door disappeared. I heard footsteps moving away in the hallway and then the door to the bridge opening and closing. I stood stock still and listened for any other sound. There was nothing. Without taking my eyes off the door, I stepped over to the reception desk and picked up the phone. I called 911 and it was answered right away, but I got a recording that told me my call was important and that I needed to hold on for the next available emergency dispatcher. I realized I was shaking, not with fear, but with the overload of adrenaline. I put the gun on the desk, checked my pocket, and found that I hadn't lost my cell phone. With the office phone in one hand, I used the other to open the cell and call Harry Bosch. He answered on the first ring.
"Bosch, that guy you showed me was just here."
"Holler? What are you talking about? Who?"
"The guy in the photo you showed me today, the one with the gun."
"All right, calm down. Where is he? Where are you?"
I realized that the stress of the moment had pulled my voice tight and sharp. Embarrassed, I took a deep breath and tried to calm myself before answering. "I'm at the office. Vincent's office. I was leaving, and I saw him in the garage. I ran back inside, and he ran in after me. He tried to get into the office. I think he's gone, but I'm not sure. I fired a couple of shots, and then..."
"You have a gun?"
"Goddamn right I do."
"I suggest you put it away before somebody gets hurt."
"If that guy's still out there, he'll be the one getting hurt. Who the hell is he?"
There was a pause before he answered.
I don't know yet. Look, I'm still downtown and was just heading home myself. I'm in the car. Sit tight, and I'll be there in 5 minutes. Stay in the office and keep the door locked. Don't worry, I'm not moving. And don't shoot me when I get there. I won't.
I reached over and hung up the office phone. I didn't need 911 if Bosch was coming. I picked the gun back up.
Hey, Holler?
What?
What did he want?
What?
The guy. What did he come there for?
That's a good goddamn question, but I don't have the answer.
Look, stop fucking around and tell me. I'm telling you! I don't know what he's after! Now quit talking and get over here!
I involuntarily squeezed my hands into fists as I yelled and put an accidental shot into the floor. I jumped as though I'd been shot at by someone else.
Holler!
Bosch yelled.
What the hell was that?
I pulled in a deep breath and took my time composing myself before answering.
Holler! What's going on?
Get over here and you'll find out.
Did you hit him? Did you put him down?
Without answering, I closed the phone. Bosch made it in 6 minutes, but it felt like an hour. A dark image appeared on the other side of the glass, and he knocked sharply.
Holler, it's me, Bosch.
Carrying the gun at my side, I unlocked the door and let him in. He, too, had his gun out and at his side.
Anything since we were on the phone?
He asked. Haven't seen or heard him. I guess I scared his ass away. Bosch holstered his gun and threw me a look, as if to say my tough guy pose was convincing no one, except maybe myself.
What was that last shot?
An accident.
I pointed toward the hole in the floor. Give me that gun, before you get yourself killed.
I handed it over, and he put it into the waistband of his pants.
You don't own a gun. Not legally. I checked.
It's my investigator's. He leaves it here at night. Bosch scanned the ceiling until he saw the two holes I had put there. He then looked at me and shook his head. He went over to the blinds and checked the street. Broadway was dead out there this time of night. A couple nearby buildings had been converted into residential lofts, but Broadway still had a way to go before recapturing the nightlife it had had 80 years before.
Okay, let's sit down, he said.
He turned from the window to see me standing behind him.
In your office.
Why?
Because we're going to talk about this.
I moved into the office and took a seat behind the desk. Bosch sat down across from me.
First of all, here's your stuff. I found it out there on the bridge.
From the pocket of his jacket, he pulled my wallet and loose bills. He put it all on the desk and then reached back in for the coins.
Okay, now what? I asked as I put my property back in my pocket.
Now we talk, Bosch said.
First off, do you want to file a report on this?
Why bother? You know about it. It's your case. Why don't you know who this guy is?
We're working on it.
That's not good enough, Bosch. He came after me. Why can't you ID him? Bosch shook his head.
Because we think he's a hitter brought in from out of town. Maybe out of the country.
That's fucking fantastic. Why did he come back here?
Obviously because of you. Because of what you know.
Me? I don't know anything.
You've been in here for 3 days. You must know something that makes you a danger to him.
I'm telling you, I've got nothing.
Then you have to ask yourself, why did that guy come back? What did he leave behind or forget the first time?
I just stared at him. I actually wanted to help. I was tired of being under the gun in more ways than one, and if I could have given Bosch just one answer, I would have. I shook my head.
I can't think of a single... Come on, Holler! Bosch barked at me. Your life is threatened here. Don't you get it? What have you got?
I told you!
Who did Vincent bribe?
I don't know, and I couldn't tell you if I did.
What did the FBI want with him?
I don't know that either.
He started pointing at me. You fucking hypocrite. You're hiding behind the protections of the law while the killer is out there waiting. Your ethics and rules won't stop a bullet, Holler. Tell me what you've got.
I told you, I don't have anything, and don't point your fucking finger at me.
This isn't my job, it's your job. And maybe if you would get it done, people around here would feel... Excuse me.
The voice came from behind Bosch. In one fluid move, he turned and pivoted out of his chair, drawing his gun and aiming it at the door. A man holding a trash bag stood there, his eyes going wide in fright. Bosch immediately lowered his weapon, and the office cleaner looked like he might faint.
Sorry, Bosch said.
I come back later,
the man said in a thick accent from Eastern Europe. He turned and disappeared quickly through the door.
God damn it,
Bosch cursed, clearly unhappy about pointing his gun at an innocent man. I doubt we'll ever get our trash cans emptied again, I said. Bosch went over to the door and closed and bolted it. He came back to the desk and looked at me with angry eyes. He sat back down, took a deep breath, and proceeded in a much calmer voice.
I'm glad you can keep your sense of humor, counselor. But enough with the fucking jokes.
All right, no jokes. Bosch looked like he was struggling internally with what to say or do next. His eyes swept the room and then held on me.
All right, look, you're right. It's my job to catch this guy, but you've had him right here. Right goddamn here. And so it stands to reason that he was here with a purpose. He came to either kill you, which seems unlikely since he apparently doesn't even know you, or he came to get something from you. The question is, what is it? What is in this office or in one of your files that could lead to the identity of the killer?
I tried to match him with an even-tempered voice of my own. All I can tell you is that I've had my case manager in here since Tuesday. I've had my investigator in here, and Jerry Vincent's own receptionist was in here up until lunchtime today when she quit. And none of us, detective, none of us, has been able to find the smoking gun you're so sure is here. You tell me that Vincent paid somebody a bribe, but I can find no indication in any file or from any client that that is true. I spent the last 3 hours in here looking at the Elliott file, and I saw no indication, not one, that he paid anybody off or bribed somebody. In fact, I found out that he didn't need to bribe anybody. Vincent had a magic bullet, and he had a shot at winning the case fair and square. So when I tell you I have nothing, I mean it. I'm not playing you. I'm not holding back. I have nothing to give you. Nothing.
What about the FBI? Same answer. Nothing.
Bosch didn't respond. I saw true disappointment cloud his face. I continued. If this mustache man is the killer, then of course there is a reason that brought him back here, but I don't know it. Am I concerned about it? No, not concerned. I'm fucking scared shitless about it. I'm fucking scared shitless that this guy thinks I have something. Because if I have it, I don't even know I have it, and that is not a good place to be. Bosch abruptly stood up. He pulled Sisko's gun out of his waistband and put it down on the desk.
Keep it loaded. And if I were you, I would stop working at night.
He turned and headed toward the door.
That's it?
I called after him. He spun in his tracks and came back to the desk.
What else do you want from me?
All you want is information from me. Most of the time, information I can't give. But you, in turn, give nothing back. And that's half the reason I'm in danger.
Bosch looked like he might be able to jump over the desk at me. But then I saw him calm himself once more. All except for the palpitation high over his cheek near his left temple. That didn't go away. That was his tell. And it was a tell that once again gave me a sense of familiarity.
Fuck it, he finally said.
What do you want to know, counselor? Go ahead, ask me a question, any question, and I'll answer it.
I want to know about the bribe. Where did the money go?
Bosch shook his head and laughed in a false way. I give you a free shot, and I say to myself that I'll answer your question, no matter what it is. And you go and ask me the question I don't have an answer to. You think if I knew where the money went and who got the bribe that I'd be here right now with you? Holler. I'd be booking a killer.
So you're sure one thing had to do with the other? That the bribe, if there was a bribe, is connected to the killing?
I'm going with the percentages.
But the bribe, if there was a bribe, went down 5 months ago. Why was Jerry killed now? Why's the FBI calling him now?
Good questions. Let me know if you come up with any answers. Meantime,
Anything else I can do for you, counselor? I was heading home when you called. Yeah, there is. He looked at me and waited. I was on my way out, too. What? You want me to hold your hand on the way to the garage? Fine, let's go. I closed the office once again, and we proceeded down the hall to the bridge to the garage. Bosch had stopped talking, and the silence was nerve-wracking. I finally broke it. I was gonna go have a steak. You want to come? Maybe we'll solve the world's problems over some red meat. Where? Musso's? I was thinking Dantana's. Bosch nodded. If you can get us in. Don't worry. I know a guy. Bosch followed me, but when I slowed on Santa Monica Boulevard to pull into the valet stop in front of the restaurant, he kept going. I saw him drive by and turn right on Doheny. I went in by myself, and Craig sat me in one of the cherished corner booths. It was a busy night, but things were tapering off. I saw the actor James Woods finishing dinner in a booth with a movie producer named Mace Neufeld. They were regulars, and Mace gave me a nod. He had once tried to option one of my cases for a film, but it didn't work out. I saw Corbin Burnson in another booth, the actor who had given the best approximation of an attorney I had ever seen on television. And then in another booth, the man himself, Dan Tana, was having a late dinner with his wife. I dropped my eyes to the checkered tablecloth. Enough who's who. I had to prepare for Bosch. During the drive, I had thought long and hard about what had just happened back at the office, and now I only wanted to think about how best to confront Bosch about it. It was like preparing for the cross-examination of a hostile witness. 10 minutes after I was seated, Bosch finally appeared in the doorway, and Craig led him to me. Get lost? I asked as he squeezed into the booth. I couldn't find a parking space. I guess they don't pay you enough for valet. No, valet's a beautiful thing, but I can't give my city car to a valet. Against the rules. I nodded, guessing that it was probably because he packed a shotgun in the trunk. I decided to wait until after we ordered to make a play with Bosch. I asked if he wanted to look at the menu, and he said he was ready to order. When the waiter came, we both ordered the steak Helen with spaghetti and red sauce on the side. Bosch ordered a beer, and I asked for a bottle of flat water. So, I said, where's your partner been lately? He's working on other aspects of the investigation. Well, I guess it's good to hear there are other aspects to it. Bosch studied me for a long moment before replying. Is that supposed to be a crack? Just an observation. Doesn't seem from my end to be much happening. Maybe that's because your source dried up and blew away. My source? I don't have any source. Not anymore. I figured out who was feeding your guy, and that ended today. I just hope you weren't paying him for the information, because IAD will take him down for that. I know you won't believe me, but I have no idea who or what you were talking about. I get information from my investigator. I don't ask him how he gets it. Bosch nodded. That's the best way to do it, right? Insulate yourself and then you don't get any blowback in your face. In the meantime, if a police captain loses his job and pension, those are the breaks. I hadn't realized Cisco's source was so highly placed. The waiter brought our drinks and a basket of bread. I drank some of the water as I contemplated what to say next. I put the glass down and looked at Bosch. He raised his eyebrows like he was expecting something. How'd you know when I was leaving the office tonight? Bosch looked puzzled. What do you mean? I figure it was the lights. You were out there on Broadway, and when I killed the lights, you sent your guy into the garage. I don't know what you're talking about. Sure you do. The photo of the guy with the gun coming out of the building. It was a phony. You set it up, choreographed it, and used it to smoke out your leak. Then you tried to scam me with it. Bosch shook his head and looked out of the booth as if he were looking for someone to help him interpret what I was saying. It was a bad act. You set up the phony picture, and then you showed it to me because you knew it would come back around through my investigator to your leak. You'd know that whoever asked you about the photo was the leak. I can't discuss any aspect of the investigation with you. And then you used it to try to play me, to see if I was hiding something, and to scare it out of me. I told you, I can't. Well, you don't have to, Bosch. I know it's what you did. You know what your mistakes were?
First of all, not coming back like you said you would to show the photo to Vincent's secretary. If the guy in the picture was legit, you would have shown it to her because she knows the clients better than me. Your second mistake was the gun in the waistband of your hitman. Vincent was shot with a .25, too small for a waistband. I missed that when you showed me the photo, but I've got it now. Bosch looked toward the bar in the middle of the restaurant. The overhead TV was showing sports highlights. I leaned across the table closer to him. So, who's the guy in the photo? Your partner with a stick-on mustache? Some clown from Vice? Don't you have better things to do than to be running a game on me? Bosch leaned back and continued to look around the place, his eyes moving everywhere but to me. He was contemplating something, and I gave him all the time he needed. Finally, he looked at me.
Okay, you got me. It was a scam. I guess that makes you one smart lawyer, Holler, just like the old man. I wonder why you're wasting it defending scumbags. Shouldn't you be out there suing doctors or defending big tobacco or something noble like that?
I smiled. Is that how you like to play it? You get caught being underhanded, so you respond by accusing the other guy of being underhanded? Bosch laughed, his face colored red as he turned away from me. It was a gesture that struck me as familiar, and his mention of my father brought him to mind. I had a vague memory of my father laughing uneasily and looking away as he leaned back at the dinner table. My mother had accused him of something I was too young to understand. Bosch put both arms on the table and leaned toward me.
You've heard of the First 48, right?
What are you talking about?
The First 48. The chances of clearing a homicide diminish by almost half each day if you don't solve it in the first 48 hours.
He looked at his watch before continuing.
I'm coming up on 72 hours, and I've got nothing, he said. Not a suspect, not a viable lead, nothing. And I was hoping that tonight I might be able to scare something out of you. Something that would point me in the right direction.
I sat there, staring at him, digesting what he had said. Finally, I found my voice. You actually thought I knew who killed Jerry and wasn't telling?
It was a possibility I had to consider.
Fuck you, Bosch. Just then the waiter came with our steaks and spaghetti. As the plates were put down, Bosch looked at me with a knowing smile on his face. The waiter asked what else he could get for us, and I waved him away without breaking eye contact. You're an arrogant son of a bitch, I said. You can just sit there with a smile on your face after accusing me of hiding evidence or knowledge in a murder of a guy I knew. Bosch looked down at his steak, picked up his knife and fork and cut into it. I noticed he was left-handed. He put a chunk of meat into his mouth and stared at me while he ate it. He rested his fists on either side of his plate, fork and knife in his grips, as if guarding the food from poachers. A lot of my clients who had spent time in prison ate the same way.
Why don't you take it easy there, counselor? He said. You have to understand something. I'm not used to being on the same side of the line as the defense lawyer, okay? It has been my experience that defense attorneys have tried to portray me as stupid, corrupt, bigoted, you name it. So with that in mind, yes, I tried to run a game on you in hopes that it would help me solve a murder. I apologize all to hell and back. If you want, I'll have them wrap up my steak and I'll take it to go.
I shook my head. Bosch had a talent for trying to make me feel guilty for his transgressions.
Maybe now you should be the one who takes it easy, I said.
All I'm saying is that from the start, I have acted openly and honestly with you. I have stretched the ethical bounds of my profession, and I've told you what I could tell you, when I could tell you. I didn't deserve to have the shit scared out of me tonight, and you're damn lucky I didn't put a bullet in your man's chest when he was at the office door. He made a beautiful target.
You weren't supposed to have a gun. I checked.
Bosch started eating again, keeping his head down as he worked on the steak. He took several bites and then moved to the side plate of spaghetti. He wasn't a twirler. He chopped at the pasta with his fork before putting a bite into his mouth. He spoke after he swallowed his food.
So, now that we have that out of the way, will you help me?
I blew out my breath in a laugh.
Are you kidding? Have you heard a single thing I've said here?
Yeah, I heard it all. And no, I'm not kidding.
When all is said and done, I still have a dead lawyer, your colleague, on my hands, and I could still use your help. I started cutting my first piece of steak. I decided he could wait for me to eat, like I had waited for him. Dantana's was considered by many to serve the best steak in the city. Count me as one of the many. I was not disappointed. I took my time, savoring the first bite, then put my fork down. What kind of help?
We draw out the killer.
Great. How dangerous will it be?
Depends on a lot of things. But I'm not going to lie to you. It could get dangerous. I need you to shake some things up. Make whoever's out there think there's a loose end, that you might be dangerous to them. Then we see what happens. But you'll be there. I'll be covered. Every step of the way.
How do we shake things up?
I was thinking a newspaper story. I assume you've been getting calls from the reporters. We pick one and give them the story, an exclusive, and we plant something in there that gets the killer thinking.
I thought about this and remembered what Lorna had warned about playing fair with the media. There's a guy at the Times, I said. I kind of made a deal with him to get him off my back. I told him that when I was ready to talk, I would talk to him.
That's a perfect setup. We'll use him.
I didn't say anything.
So, are you in?
I picked up my fork and knife and remained silent while I cut into the steak again. Blood ran onto the plate. I thought about my daughter getting to the point of asking me the same questions her mother asked, and that I could never answer. It's like you're always working for the bad guys. It wasn't as simple as that, but knowing this didn't take away the sting or the look I remembered seeing in her eyes. I put the knife and fork down without taking a bite. I suddenly was no longer hungry.
Yeah, I said. I'm in.
Part 3. To speak the truth. Everybody lies. Cops lie. Lawyers lie. Clients lie. Even jurors lie. There's a school of belief in criminal law that says every trial is won or lost in the choosing of the jury. I've never been ready to go all the way to that level, but I do know that there is probably no phase in a murder trial more important than the selection of the 12 citizens who will decide your client's fate. It is also the most complex and fleeting part of the trial, reliant on the whims of fate and luck, and being able to ask the right question of the right person at the right time. And yet we begin each trial with it. Jury selection in the case of California versus Elliott began on schedule in Judge James P. Stanton's courtroom at 10 a.m. Thursday. The courtroom was packed, half filled with the veniri, the 80 potential jurors called randomly from the jury pool on the third floor of the CCB, and half filled with media, courthouse professionals, well-wishers, and just plain gawkers who had been able to squeeze in. I sat at the defense table alone with my client, fulfilling his wish for a legal team of just one. Spread in front of me was an open but empty manila file, a post-it pad, and three different markers, red, blue, and black. Back at the office, I had prepared the file by using a ruler to draw a grid across it. There were 12 blocks, each the size of a post-it. Each block was for one of the 12 jurors who would be chosen to sit in judgment of Walter Elliott. Some lawyers use computers to track potential jurors. They even have software that can take information revealed during the selection process, filter it through a socio-political pattern, recognition program, and spit out instant recommendations on whether to keep or reject a juror. I had been using the old-school grid system since I'd been a baby lawyer in the public defender's office. It had always worked well for me, and I wasn't changing now. I didn't want to use a computer's instincts when it came to picking a jury. I wanted to use my own. A computer can't hear how someone gives an answer. It can't see someone's eyes when they lie. The way it works is that the judge has a computer-generated list from which he calls the first 12 citizens from the veniri, and they take seats in the jury box. At that point, each is a member of the jury, but they get to keep their seats only if they survive voir dire, the questioning of their background and views and understanding of the law. There is a process.
The judge asks them a series of basic questions, and then the lawyers get the chance to follow up with a more narrow focus. Jurors can be removed from the box in one of two ways. They can be rejected for cause if they show through their answers or demeanor, or even their life circumstances, that they cannot be fair judges of credibility or hear the case with an open mind. There is no limit to the number of challenges for cause at the disposal of the attorneys. Oftentimes, the judge will make a dismissal for cause before the prosecutor or defense attorney even raises an objection. I have always believed that the quickest way off a jury panel is to announce that you are convinced that all cops lie, or all cops are always right. Either way, a closed mind is a challenge for cause. The second method of removal is the peremptory challenge, of which each attorney is given a limited supply, depending on the type of case and charges. Because this trial involved charges of murder, both the prosecution and defense would have up to 20 peremptory challenges each. It is in the judicious and tactful use of these peremptories that strategy and instinct come into play. A skilled attorney can use his challenges to help sculpt the jury into a tool of the prosecution or defense. A peremptory challenge lets the attorney strike a juror for no reason other than his instinctual dislike of the individual. An exception to this would be the obvious use of peremptories to create a bias on the jury. A prosecutor who continually removed black jurors, or a defense attorney who did the same with white jurors, would quickly run afoul of the opposition as well as the judge. The rules of voir dire are designed to remove bias and deception from the jury. The term itself comes from the French phrase to speak the truth, but this, of course, is contradictory to each side's cause. The bottom line in any trial is that I want a biased jury. I want them biased against the state and the police. I want them predisposed to be on my side.